Other speakers have been speaking about making out various kinds of sound from text, and I suppose in a way I'll be going in the other direction. I'm interested in mishearings. Mishearings often attach themselves to popular or traditional forms of utterance, the semi-scrutable topoi of impersonal belief or authority. In some societies, this may mean chants, prayers and hymns. In others, fables, anthems, proverbs, and, most particularly, popular songs. Mishearings in this last category have attracted enthusiastic attention from collectors who know them as mondegreens. This evocative term was proposed by Sylvia Wright in 1954. She recalled the images that had been summoned up for her when hearing as a child the ballad The Earl of Murray. Ye Highlands and ye Lowlands, oh, where ha' ye been? They ha' slain the Earl of Murray and the Lady Mondegreen. The fact that the Earl's mysterious tragic partner, the Lady Mondegreen, has neither been named nor alluded to up to this point in the ballad, and receives no mention thereafter, made no difference to the vividness with which the young Sylvia imagined the noble lady meeting her death. I saw it all clearly. The Earl had yellow curly hair and a yellow beard and, of course, wore a kilt. He was lying in a forest clearing with an arrow in his heart. Lady Mondegreen lay at his side, her long, dark brown curls spread out over the moss. She wore a dark green dress embroidered with light green leaves outlined in gold. It had a low neck trimmed with lace, Irish lace, I think. An arrow had pierced her throat. From it, blood trickled over the lace. Sunlight coming through the leaves made dappled shadows on her cheeks and her closed eyelids. She was holding the Earl's hand. It made me cry. But the Lady Mondegreen doesn't exist, any more than Hamlet's otherwise unacknowledged Irish co-conspirator when he whispers of his murderous opportunity with the praying Claudius. Now might we do it, Pat. What she should have heard was, they have slain the Earl of Murray and they've laid him on the green. Mondegreens are an indication of the state of semi-apperceptive reverie in which much popular sentiment and doxa are absorbed and resonate, and the mongrel meeting in it of private association and public utterance. As soon as one begins to look or listen closely, it turns out that listeners to popular music in particular seem to grope in a fog of blunder, botch, and misprision, making flailing stabs at sense in the face of what seems to be a world of largely unintelligible utterance. Usually, the substituted versions of the lyrics are pathetic in various ways, often turning implausible romantic fantasy into realism, like those cynics who assume that the monkeys, "Then I saw her face, now I'm a believer," is in fact, "Then I saw her face, now I'm gonna leave her." The Mondegreen will often puncture lyric or operatic pretension with corporeal particularity, as in the mishearing of the portentous Daphne du Maurier-like beginning of Madonna's La Isla Bonita, "Last night I dreamt of San Pedro," as "Last night I dreamt of some bagels." Gavin Edwards, one of a number of long-standing collectors of Mondegreens, points out that, quote, "they tend to be about primal concerns, food, sex and animals. Any misheard lyric is an impromptu audio Rorschach test. It can be alarming to discover that significant parts of our brains seem to want pop songs to cover the lyrical topics of cheese, walruses and clowns." This might be confirmed by the florid Mondegreen which rendered Buddy Fuller's 1965 "I fought the law and the law won" as "hot dogs in love in a round world." Sometimes, Mondegreens can transform lyrics of painful banality into something rich and strange, like the person who sharpened, "I can see clearly now the rain has gone. I can see all obstacles in my way," as "I can see all life's fickles in the way." Life's fickles is positively Shakespearean, I think. But although mishearings may appear pleasingly to disorder or loosen sense, they are, in essence and principle, I think, negentropic, which is to say, they push back up the slope from random noise to the redundancy of voice, moving from the direction of nonsense to sense, of non-direction to direction. They seem to represent the intolerance of pure phenomena. In this, they're different from the misspeakings, or lapsus linguae, with which they're often associated. Seeing slips of the ear as simply the auditory complement of slips of the tongue mistakes their positive, even their programmatic nature and function. Misspeakings are the disorderings of sense by nonsense. Mishearings are the wrenchings of nonsense into sense. Mishearings that substitute intelligibility for plausibility are paralleled by auditory hallucinations that move sound from the non-vocal to the vocal, allowing ordinary sounds to be heard as voices. John Percival, a 19th century psychiatric patient who wrote a detailed account of his delusions, described such a condition, which we might call that of a panophonia, the production of voices out of ordinary sounds, especially, in John Percival's case, the internal sounds of his own body. I found that the breathing of my nostrils also, particularly when I was agitated, had been and was clothed with words and sentences. The sound of air was particularly liable to become, in Percival's expressive phrase, clothed with articulation. He describes, for example, his fear at the approach of his attendants. Their footsteps talked to me as they came upstairs. The breathing of their nostrils over me as they unfastened me whispered threatenings. A machine I used to hear at work pumping spoke horrors. On another occasion, Percival identified gas jets as the source of voices. Continually, he wrote, over the head of the bed, at the left-hand side, as if in the ceiling, there was a sound as the voice of many waters, and I was made to imagine that the jets of gas that came from the fireplace on the left-hand side were the utterance of my father's spirit, which was continually within me, attempting to save me, and continually obliged to return to be purified in hellfire in consequence of the contamination it received from my foul thoughts. Now, this kind of processing of the sounds of the inanimate world as voices may strike us as a pretty marginal or anomalous phenomenon. However, some recent work designed to explain why THC, the active component of cannabis, might sometimes trigger schizophrenic delusion points in a somewhat different direction. A researcher called Zerrin Atakan of London's Institute of Psychiatry has conducted experiments which suggest that subjects who've been given small doses of THC were much less able to inhibit involuntary actions. She suggests that THC might induce psychotic hallucinations, especially the auditory hallucinations, which are classically associated with paranoid delusion, by suppressing the response inhibition which would normally prevent us from reacting to non-vocal sounds as though they were voices. The implications of this argument are intriguing, for it seems to imply that far from only occasionally or accidentally hearing voices in sounds, we have in fact continuously and actively to inhibit this tendency. Perhaps without this kind of filter, the wind would always and for all of us be whispering Mary or Malcolm. Maybe the most intriguing example of voice divining is to be found in the practice of playing records or tapes backwards to make out subliminal or secret messages. This practice goes back at least as far as the rumours that circulated about the bit of gabble that occupied the run-out groove of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's album. Never could be any other way, some people hear it as. Such messages have increasingly, in more recent years, been taken to be satanic in intent and even perhaps in origin. The most famous of these is a passage of Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven.
If there's a bustle in your hedgerow, don't be alone there. It's just a sprinkling for the May Queen. Yes, there are two good in the long run. And there's still time to change the road you're on.
Played backwards, this gives us the following. The secret hymn to Satan seems to be doubled by the suggestion that with these sucking tones, we may actually be listening to Satan's voice or that of some lieutenant demon. There is actually a long tradition which associates inversiveness of sound, with diabolical speech, whether in the form of the Black Mass, in which the Latin Mass and the Lord's Prayer are intoned backwards, or the speaking on the in-breath rather than the out-breath that was thought by some to explain the characteristic hollowness of the voice in ventriloquism, or to indicate the presence of a devil in the voice. In this case, I find the lurch of register from the Miltonic sonority of "Whose power is Satan?" to the infantile scariness of the little tool shed rapturously comic. The kind of suffering that might get inflicted in a tool shed by a Satan who's obviously sad because he's been locked in for his naughtiness and might involve some kind of fiendish improvisations with a lawn rake or rawl plugs would be both exquisite and ridiculous. All of this allows the demonic to be thought of not so much as the opposite and opponent of speech, as a kind of minor but insidious perturbation of it. The devil works parasitically in the mode of dissembling. The swerve, the near miss, the faux ami, the fly in the ointment, or the teleportation chamber. Thus, the voice of the devil is felt somehow virally to infiltrate and inhabit Robert Plant's voice, rather than simply to displace or overcome it. The marginal kinds of interference and variation associated with the devil are apparent also, of course, in the story of the verses interpolated into the angel's dictation to Muhammad that are the generative heart of Salman Rushdie's The Satanic Verses. Many examples of mondegreens involve children trying to make sense of mysterious adult language. That is, they involve a third category of sense lying between the alternatives of the meaningless and the meaningful, a third category we might call the meant to mean. The mondegreening ear may be said to belong to or recall the tendency to regard everything as potentially full of import, simmering with possible significance and insurgent vocality. The child listening to prayers and religious language and processing their outlandishness into homely, if implausible, intelligibility. Think of the young Sylvia Wright, for example, who hears, "His goodness and mercy will follow me all the days of my life," as "the good Mrs. Murphy will follow me all the days of my life." This child is responding sensitively to the heightened expectation of meaningfulness, the aura with which such language throbs. And the retitling of hymns by Adam Buxton, of which I'm going to give you a little example now.
How wonderful to think that the new tower will be enjoyed.
Here's an example of this.
Thank you.
If we can view mishearings as a kind of defence or retaliation against nonsense or pure noise, then it would make it natural for their most fertile source to be in vocal music, especially popular song. But one might also wonder whether the ear's desire for integration might function without the presence or possibility of words or voices. It certainly does look as though listeners to music will, under many circumstances, regularize or round up deficient tunings or harmonies or rhythms, for example, into what it assumes the music intends, or perhaps what it intends that the music shall intend. Perhaps the experiences of heightened significance that readers of poetry and art lovers in general report may involve some recall of this apprehension of the world as meaning to mean. The expectation or conjuring of a world that is meaning to mean may also indicate how non-vocal music may be subject to reparative or reconstructive mishearing, as a result of which the phenomenality of musical sound comes to be heard as expressive or intentional act, a kind of saying without a said, the gesture or posture of vocality without the specifics of speech. One might even suggest that this regularizing, resampling, or rounding up occurs whenever one brings to bear the kind of attention that we typically donate to the kinds of sounds we take or expect to be musical. We may feel that in listening to music, we somehow give ourselves over to it, more or less passively. But in fact, musical listening and listening musically may activate a minor form of the hallucination involved in the Mondegreen, in which we actively give to the sounds we hear a kind of structure and expressive intent that they might otherwise not possess if perceived as simple sound. Music, of course, is often strongly implicated in the contrast drawn between merely hearing and more actively listening to sound. It's not simply that we listen to music while we just hear sound. It's also that whatever we listen to in a certain way, that is to say, musically, may seem thereby to have a musical effect and intent. I think it would be a mistake, however, to think of this as a distinction simply between conscious and unconscious auditory function. Consider the experience of suddenly hearing a background noise subside. A computer powers down. The noise of its fan dies away. An air conditioning unit suddenly cuts out. The refrigerator shudders into silence. The thrum of a car engine in the street outside is suddenly, deliciously gone. The sensation is being delivered of a burden that we had no notion we were bearing. The abatement of a labor we did not realize we were undertaking. A casual explanation might be that in a case like this, we've been hearing something without consciously listening to it. I don't think this sufficiently accounts, though, for the work that we suddenly realize we've been doing in holding the noise at bay, in keeping it from being heard. Indeed, it might seem better to put it the other way around, to say that we've been listening to something without being able to hear it. Or better, perhaps, listening to it in order precisely to prevent it from becoming audible. There has been an intense and depleting ear work, analogous to the Freudian dream work or joke work, a work, however, of which we only can become conscious at the moment at which we are abruptly, blissfully relieved of it. Michel Serres, in his book The Five Senses, recently translated into English, but in other works besides, often makes of the ear a kind of detection apparatus for what is otherwise silenced by the work of language. Myriad things shout out, he writes. Often deaf to unusual transmissions, our hearing is astonished by the shouts of things which have no name in any language. But what I've been saying so far should suggest that the operation of hearing is to be understood otherwise than as this exposure, whether patient or impassioned, of which Serres, along with others, Lyotard, for example, have been wont to speak. In seemingly just lying open to the world, the ear is in fact lying vigilantly in wait for it. It effects a gathering in, a knitting together, an appropriation. In other words, listening is full of replay, relay and feedback, the ear monitoring or listening in on or listening out for its own operations. Maybe in this sense, all hearing is mishearing, a kind of deterrence of sound. Nothing, it seems, can get in or out without passing through this breakwater or firewall, this autistic tool shed in which what has been apprehended by the ear can only be heard once it has been tortured into coherence. Hearing in waking is maybe conducted pretty much as it is in sleep. It tunes, tickets, and smooths the incoming sound to keep continuous the complex, agitated waking dream or dream of waking. Hearing, and perhaps the hearing of music especially, attempts unceasingly to effect a kind of palindrome or hysteron proteron, whereby every sound can be anticipated or headed off by the pre-understanding of it, constituted by it precisely being heard as this or that. Hearing perception is best thought of as interception, the making out of sounds, not least by making them out as distinct and separate sounds, the making out of sounds as what they will have been before they have a chance to resound as what they might actually be. Without such systematic mishearing, there can be nothing to be heard but only the raw and amorphous racketings of noise. The intensively active process of filleting out signal from noise helps account for the extraordinarily highly developed capacity that human listeners have to distinguish the phonemic, the meaningful units of sound, from the merely phonological, the sound of speech as such. Edward Sapir remarked of his interpreter of the Nootka language that he had the curious feeling that he was transcribing, I'm quoting Sapir now, he was transcribing an ideal flow of phonetic elements, which he heard as the intention of the actual rumble of speech. In speech, something like a consensual audible hallucination occurs, in which hearer and speaker agree to share the work of compressing and filtering the actual rumble of speech with all its acoustic accidents and anomalies into the ideal abstract sound of words in a line. It is social ventriloquism of an extremely high order of subtlety, which depends upon intricately coordinated or synchronized mishearing. This is nicely illustrated by a UK experiment in which employees behind a post office counter systematically, but as it turned out undetectedly, concluded every transaction with a cheery, "fuck you, fuck you, fuck you," which was infallibly reconstrued as the thank you the customer thought was their due. But this example suggests a slightly different way of thinking about mishearing, which has been suggested by the writer and sometimes sound artist Paul Carter. Carter suggests that mishearing might be thought of not as communicative misfire, but as a kind of process of tuning between partners in a dialogue. In such a process, the corrective internal retransmission, which I've been evoking, is supplemented by an external retransmission, whereby mishearing is given voice and itself made subject to further mishearing and correction. Carter reads ambiguity and error as a process of echolocation between the dialogic partners in speech encounters, a process which isn't just an accident that befalls communication, to be protected against, therefore, but the aperture and prolongation of a space of exchange that, Carter believes, recapitulates the beginnings of all communication, and may even be constitutive of it itself. This acoustically shaped placemaking, as Carter calls it, is the space of echo and feedback opened and occupied by the child who hears its blurs and bishes recognized, resampled, and offered for rehearing by interlocutors in its auditory environment. It's also, and this is the particular kind of placemaking in which Carter is most interested, characteristic of the so-called first encounter between peoples, especially settler and indigenous peoples. Carter reminds us of how often and how notoriously such encounters involve mishearings and misapprehensions, focusing in particular on the meeting between Columbus and the Taino people. Such exchanges involve a rather different relation between noise and signal from those suggested in the story I've been telling so far of the unsleeping effort to divert sound into sense. Instead of a unidirectional process of integration and sense-making, along with its comic or dangerous derailings, there would be a kind of circulation, a back-and-forth sounding out, precisely a conversing in which every response is a kind of transformation. Speaking then becomes a kind of remote sensing mechanism. The tongue's attempts are a tentative as if ear, extruded snail horn-wise, in order to try to adjust and refocus what has always just now been half heard. As a proof of this, we might take note of the fact that the Mondegreener seems so rarely to be dismayed by the revelation of the correct lyric. Rather, an oscillation is instituted in which the intended reading and its near-miss cousin furnish each other's background, thus creating a kind of echoic space between correctness and misprision. Mishearing doesn't go one way, and for that very reason, never simply goes away. It iterates, oscillates, reverberates. In a letter written to the Guardian newspaper, Chris Davis claims that having become aware of the common mishearing of "Excuse me while I kiss the sky" in Purple Haze as "Excuse me while I kiss this guy," Jimi Hendrix would mime an apparently osculatory sally on his bass player Noel Redding while actually singing the lyric. Some songs, like I Am the Walrus, seems to institute and occupy such a paranomasic space. I Am the Walrus seems less like an exercise in surrealist free association or automatic writing, and more like a kind of fed-back auto-mishearing. Crab-a-locker fishwife, pornographic priestess, man, you should have seen them kicking Edgar Allan Poe, sounds exactly like the kind of lungingly specific guesses that the ear desperate to make out significance might throw out. We might think of the whole song as the transcription and feeding back of a series of mishearings of an original not quite lost between layers of misapprehension. A particularly beautiful and expressive enactment of this goalless ebb and flow of the sound in between, as Carter calls it, is to be found in the Anna Livia Plurabelle section of Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, in which we're to imagine that we're overhearing the gossip being exchanged by two washerwomen scrubbing clothes on opposite banks of the Liffey. As they slosh and slap and ring, their efforts to make themselves heard above the river seem to result in a sudsy lathering up of location, locution, and laundry, making their words steadily more waterlogged, not least with the names of hundreds of world rivers. Since their discourse is so closely intermingled with the current of the river, and remember that discourse is discurrere, a running back and forth, they seem themselves to be swept downstream in the gush of their own torrential gossip. The further on they move in and are moved by their discourse, the more widely the two banks of the babbling river diverge. And as the chapter gurgles to its close, the speech of the two women that has soaked up much of its aqueous environment itself starts to become silted up. In the dimming evening light, amid the dissipating din of the river's spate, their voices are lost to each other and to themselves, as one of them starts to turn into a stone and the other into a tree, the names of which echo Shem and Sean, the sons of Anna Livia Plurabelle. Here's James Joyce reading it.
I'm here with the waters of, the chittering waters of, flittering bats, field mice, bark, talk. Oh, are you not gone a-home? What, Tom Malone? Can't hear with bark of bats all the listening waters of. Oh, talk, save us. My goose won't moose. I feel as old as yonder elm. A tale told of Sean of Shem, all Livia's daughter son. Dark hawks hear us. My whole head falls. I feel as heavy as yonder stone. Tell me of Sean of Shem. Who were Shem and Sean, the living sons and daughters of? Night now, tell me, tell me, tell me, Elm. Night, night, tell me tale of stem of stone, beside the rivering waters of, hither and thithering waters of, nigh.
Paul Carter makes the point that a resonating dialogue of this kind, in which each of the partners sounds each other out through their mimetic speech, also may draw the acoustic environment into the exchange. This resonation, as we may perhaps call it, occurs not just between the two interlocutors, but also between those interlocutors and the specific space that furnishes their locale. It is an interlocution, that is, a locution, an echolocation of the inter, the obdurate efforts of the human ear to damp sound down into meaning, can never be wholly overcome. But they may sometimes be held in abeyance by these mixed sound bodies of word and world.